sex, lies, and horse racing. Believe it or not, they can make you better at your job. Hello, and welcome to the 1-3-20 podcast, the show designed to give you the most value in the shortest time. I'm your host, Daniel Pink. In each episode, I choose one great book, ask its author three key questions, and get you on your way with big ideas and action items in under 20 minutes. The 1-3-20 podcast. It's powered by HubSpot because those guys love a good story. Let's dive right in. Today's book is Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. The author is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. Everybody Lies is one of my favorite books of the year. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Daniel.
So, I love this book. I think it's fascinating. But for our listeners out there, let's start with the question we always start with, which is this. What's the big idea in Everybody Lies?
I would say the big idea is the world is not what it seems. We're constantly fooled on how the world really works by our own faulty intuition, but also because other people are frequently lying to us. People aren't what they seem. They try to present a certain front that is different from their true attitudes, their true desires, their true actions.
In other words, as the title says, everybody lies. So what do we lie about, Seth? Give us an example of that. We have intuitions about ourselves and other people, but those intuitions are disconfirmed by some of the research that you write about. Give us an example of that.
So one of my favorite example, and it's maybe a little racy, is how much sex people have.
Okay,
so
we're interested in that here.
Okay. If you ask people how the general social survey, kind of the main sociological survey in the United States, asks people how frequently they have sex, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual sex, and whether they use a condom. And heterosexual women say they have sex once a week and use a condom 20% of the time. You do the math, they're saying they use 1.1 billion condoms in heterosexual sexual encounters. Heterosexual men, you do the same calculation, they're using 1.6 billion condoms in heterosexual sexual encounters. So you already know those numbers.
So we already have a half billion condom gap here, as the economists would call it.
Yeah, exactly. And then so I got data from Nielsen on how many condoms are sold every year in the United States. Only 600 million condoms are sold every year. So basically everybody now is lying about how many condoms they're using. That doesn't mean they're lying. Are they lying about safe sex or sex in general? I think it's the latter, because if you ask how frequently people say they're having unprotected sex with no contraception with women of fertility age, if they were really having that much unprotected sex, there would actually be more pregnancies every year in the United States.
And what's the pregnancy shortfall right now?
There should be about twice as many pregnancies. So basically, I think everybody is lying about sex now, saying they're having more than they are, because I think in our sex-obsessed culture, there are pressures to have sex. And I think another key point of this book is that there are now certain sources where we can get more honest information, and particularly our Google searches, where people are really, really honest. People have an incentive to tell the truth. And on Google, the number one complaint about a marriage by far is that it's a sexless marriage. Mm. The number one complaint that everybody has about a partner, whether it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, or wife, is that the partner won't have sex with me.
So we're telling the truth to Google about our sex lives, and we're telling lies about the 1 billion additional condoms we claim to use each year.
Exactly.
Why is that?
It's weird that people lie to surveys. I think there are two reasons people lie to surveys. One is that we lie to ourselves a lot. So we may think, you know, looking back, we're pretty bad at remembering what we did. And we may look back and say, yeah, it was about once a week, even if it was, you know, twice the whole year. But we also lie so frequently to other people, kind of white lies as we go through our life. We lie to friends, we lie to our partners, we lie to our kids, sometimes to be nice, just be nice human beings. But these habits kind of carry over into surveys.
But we tell the truth to Google. So give us another example of how Google reveals something about ourselves, about our tendencies that we might not want to admit in public.
Well, one of them that people don't like to admit in public is racism, and I've done a lot of research on that. When I started this research, I was shocked by how frequently Americans were making explicitly racist searches, particularly for jokes mocking African Americans, and also the places people were making these searches. They were making them not just in the Deep South, where historically we've thought there was a huge racism problem, but also in many parts of the Northeast and Midwest and industrial Michigan and Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, upstate New York. And these racist searches geographically predict a lot of political behaviors, such as opposition to Obama in previous elections or support for Donald Trump in the primary.
Okay, so what we revealed here is that the United States is populated by racist celibates, essentially. No.
I mean, I haven't correlated the two yet, but that would be the next.
That's true. We don't know. We'd have a Venn diagram between sexless people and racist people. It'd be interesting to find out. What we have here are some really interesting insights into some things that, we care about but often are constrained talking about in public, things like sex and race. It's all very interesting, Seth. So let me ask you the second question in our interview, which is this. Why should I care? I mean, if I am a salesperson trying to do my job a little bit better, if I'm a teacher trying to motivate students, if I'm a doctor treating patients, why should I care about this?
Well, I think part of the book is just explaining the big data revolution and why it matters and the importance of using data to make decisions. So I talk about in the book this story of this guy, Jeff Sater, who has spent the last couple decades trying to figure out what makes a great racehorse. And he's decided—
This is the guy who's not a racing expert.
Yeah, I actually went down to Ocala, Florida for a horse show, which is really interesting to interview him. And most of the people involved in horse racing grew up in the business. They're third generation horse people from Kentucky or Florida. Jeff Sater's from Philadelphia. He has like 3 degrees from Harvard. But he became obsessed with trying to figure out what makes a great horse. And he wanted to basically build a huge database of everything he could find on horses and figure out what correlates with success. And he had huge amounts of failure for a long time. But then he finally started using these new tools to measure the size of internal organs of horses and found certain key organs correlate with how good a horse is going to be, particularly, for example, the size of the left ventricle. And he actually started, it has a huge correlation, and he started measuring while everybody else was kind of just looking at horses and, using their gut to make decisions on whether a horse looked like a great horse, he was actually going in and measuring their left ventricles. And he found American Pharoah had a 99.8 percentile left ventricle.
Wow. American Pharoah, of course, is the horse that ultimately went on to win the Triple Crown.
Yeah. And he basically was the one who spotted American Pharoah and said that this horse is basically a once-in-a-generation talent just based on his data analysis. So I think no matter what field you're into, there is probably somewhere there the equivalent of a left ventricle. And if you don't find it, someone else is. So what's kind of going to predict what your customers are going to do? There probably is some piece of data somewhere out there, and you have to be entrepreneurial possibly to find it or hire other people to find it. But if you don't find it, you can get killed by the Jeff Saters of the world who do find it.
Right. And you found something a little bit similar with markers of creditworthiness. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. So there's a study, Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending site. And there's a study by professors where they analyzed all the loan applications on this site. And they could predict with high accuracy if somebody would pay back the loan based on the words they use in their application.
So they're not taking their credit score. We're not doing a credit check or anything like that. Simply the words they used to fill out their application gave us a way to predict who was going to pay back their loans and who was not.
Yeah, and there are, some of them also go to the point that everybody lies. One of the biggest predictors of not paying back was including the phrase "I promise" in your credit in your credit application, and some of them are, I would say, a little bit disturbing from an ethical perspective. A big predictor was using the word "God." Mm. If you use the word "God" in a loan application, you're 2.2 times more likely to default, 2.2 times less likely to pay back. So basically, a lender from a profit maximizing perspective would be wise to downgrade anybody who, says "God bless you" in their loan application.
Yeah, obviously some ethical and even some legal problems with that, but still, it does give us some interesting insights. So we should care about this because no matter what our domain is, Seth, there's a left ventricle out there for us to find.
I think that's right. I think when people hear big data, they think of enormous data sets that have, millions or billions of observations, and they just got to collect the biggest data set in the world. And that's frequently not the case. Jeff Sater's only had, tens of thousands of observations on horses, not millions or billions. But frequently it's about finding some new variable that is far more predictive than anything else, like the left ventricle.
Do you find, I don't know if there's research on this, but are people, say, from outside a particular domain more likely to look for that unlikely source of causation than people who are in a domain?
I think that's right in general. The people who have been in the horse business for three generations grow up told what to look for in a horse, you know, the horse's pedigree or, any marks on their body or whether they look like a nerdy horse or a cool horse, things like that. And then
what does a nerdy horse look like?
I don't know.
Like a big glasses, that kind of thing?
I spent so much time in Alcala that I followed these people around, and that's what they were doing. They were analyzing the nerdiness of a horse. I didn't understand it, but they apparently did. But it is kind of, when you're trained your whole life on what to look for, it can be difficult to think outside the box. Whereas if you come at it from a totally different angle, you're not as likely to follow the traditional model.
Okay, so if we want to become the next Jeff Sater and spot things that other people aren't spotting using big data, that leads inexorably to our third question, Seth, which is this. I know that big data is revealing things about people's propensities, their proclivities, their beliefs, their actions, even though they're lying about them on the surface. I know that I should care because big data is becoming more powerful and can yield some fresh insights. Now the third question, what should I do?
Maybe a better way to answer that is, what do I not do? And I think the mistake that people would make with big data is just hiring, picking a nerdy horse, picking the nerdiest possible data analyst, mm-hmm. someone with a very traditional background in data science, and kind of having them throw all their data into models and seeing what happens. I found that's less successful. I tend to find that the biggest insights come from people from a little bit of a different background, more creative. The technical aspects of data science are less complicated than most people think.
Mm-hmm.
The best data science is having some people who have kind of enough technical know-how to run the models, but then debating the findings out with people from a wide range of backgrounds and kind of thinking through any alternative explanations. I find that in general, people from all backgrounds have important things to say. Everybody's been thinking about human beings their entire life and patterns in their behavior and what it means. So most people have important insights in data science.
So one step, I guess, would be to assemble the right team. And that team doesn't have to be huge, and it doesn't have to be full of incredibly technically sophisticated people.
The mistake that a lot of people make is they'll leave data science to a technical group and kind of just let them make all the decisions and ignore them. And that's, I think, a big mistake. I think having a more collaborative process with creative left-brain and right-brain people is a much, much more likely to yield important insights. And then being creative in where you get the data. Again, don't just mm-hmm. accept the data you have as the only possible data. Is there something else out there? Is there a left ventricle that we need to find? And how might we go about finding it?
What about this idea of challenging the assumptions of your field?
Yeah, I think that's really important as well. I also just talk about in general how frequently conventional wisdom is wrong, and that's one of the ways that data science can be most effective is just throwing away the conventional wisdom. I talk about in basketball how forever there's been this idea that basketball players are more likely to come from poor urban environments because they're basically desperate and they want to get out of the project so badly that they'll do whatever it takes, whereas boys from suburban, middle-class, two-parent homes don't have the same drive. And you see, college coaches have used this. They've been more likely to look for players from the projects, but this is just dead wrong in the data. You see that middle-class, two-parent homes are far more likely to produce NBA players.
While we're talking about what to do, let's say that I am a salesperson for an industrial company, and I don't fully control everything that my company does. But I read this book, and I want to do something about it on my own. Is there a way that an individual can just get a little bit smarter on understanding big data?
So one thing I also talk about in the book is A/B testing, and that's this idea that you can do little experiments to see what works, and this is really, really powerful because, again, people frequently, our intuition is frequently wrong. We don't understand how the world works. We think something works, or we've been told something works, and we just go with it and lose money for 5, 10, 20 years with this faulty model of how the world works, and experiments can change that. And one of the reasons that Silicon Valley companies are so successful is they use experimentation more than anybody else. It's two lines of code to do an A-B test, and Facebook does more experiments in a single day than the FDA does an entire year.
That's extraordinary. Back up a little bit and tell us about what an A-B test is.
So Facebook will just show two versions of their site to different groups of users. One, they might show, a button will be blue for one group and red for another group, and they'll see which one gets more people to click. Or they'll change the font on their site and see if that leads people to spend more time on their site. So they're constantly just doing little experiments in what their website looks like to see what gets users to do things that are better for Facebook. Now, you can do this technically. There's actually a company, Optimizely, which allows companies to build a testing interface. And I think if you're a big enough company, if you have power to make these decisions, you should definitely do it because you're going to get destroyed by companies that are doing A-B testing if you don't do it. But even if you don't build an entire automated system, I think testing and experimentation in general are drastically underutilized by people in their everyday life. My friends and I have this expression, A-B test it. It's not just for actual like website decisions, but just what I'm going to wear, A-B test it. So wear a blue shirt half the time and a red shirt half the time and see which allows you to pick up more dates or something, or just A-B test the way you talk.
And I'm curious, what are the results of that particular A-B test?
I'm guessing red. For me.
Oh.
No, blue shirts for me. So, yeah, no, I think
see,
one of the
so I've challenged my assumption. I assumed that it would
one
be
of the,
red.
One and, of the things, one of the things I mentioned in the book, which is really, really important, is you guess A-B testing wrong all the time. Because we just constantly convince ourselves we understand how the world works, and we just don't. So we build up these assumptions based on things we read or things we heard or golly knows what other reasons, and then you put it to a test, and the result is the exact opposite of what you expected.
So we've talked a lot about what we can do in our business lives, but what about in our personal lives? How do we use big data in our personal lives?
Well, one way to do this is to say how it's changed my life and how doing research on this topic for the past 5 years has changed my life. And I think it's made me more comfortable in my dealings with the world and less insecure. I think I lived a good portion of my life feeling like there was something wrong with me, or I was weird, or I didn't fit in. And now, kind of from analyzing this data that's so honest, and I talk about sexuality, I actually analyze data from Pornhub, the largest porn site in the United States. And so when you analyze this data, you see how different people are from how they present themselves. And I might spend an evening analyzing Pornhub data, and then the next morning I walk through. Walk down Madison Avenue and see all these people in suits and ties, and it's like, oh, these are the same people that were in my data set the night before. That's kind of interesting. It's kind of the equivalent of, how do you improve your public speaking? Well, there's that famous advice, imagine everyone in their underwear, right? And kind of I think the equivalent for me, and maybe it'll have some of the effect if you read this book for readers, is that it's kind of imagine you had everybody's search history. I think it's a little harder to be intimidated by other people, and you kind of realize that, insecurity is widespread, or anxiety is widespread, and that people can be very different from the polished ways they present themselves.
And the reason, of course, is that everybody lies. That's the name of the book we're talking about today. Everybody lies, big data, new data, and what the internet can tell us about who we really are. It's by Seth Stevens Davidowitz. It is one of the best books I have read this year. I encourage you to pick it up. I think you should care about it, and I think you should do something about it. Seth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Daniel.